This is Paul Revelot speaking on the 19th of April, 1988. Today I'm speaking with Richard L. Barton of Lakeville, Connecticut. Richard, better known as Dick. Dick, where were you born?
I was born in Salisbury.
In Salisbury, yeah. On your father's farm?
No, at the house on Route 41.
At the house on Route, yeah. On Route 41. Is that right in the village or north of the village?
It's east of the village.
East of the village.
Yeah. On what? The old Ashman place. The old Willard farm.
Oh. Your father lived there at that
yeah.
time? On the old Willard farm. I didn't know that. Well, that was after he left the farm
after he left the
Undermountain Road.
That's right.
Route 41. What year were you born?
I was born in 1928.
And the date of your birth?
The 4th of March.
4th of March,
1928.
Your father, whom I knew very well, your father's name was George. Did he have a middle initial?
George Edward
Barton. And your mother was Mary?
Mary McLean.
McLean. Mary McLean, whom I knew also when I was a kid. How do you spell that McLean? There are a couple of McLean spellings in town. One is M-C-L-A-I-N, the other is M-C-L-E-A-N.
McLean, M-C-L-A-I-N.
A is spelled M-C-L-A-I-N. And she was the daughter of local people who had lived here for some time?
Yes, she was.
She was. Where did she live before she married your father? Do you remember?
She lived in Canaan.
She lived in Canaan. Yeah. And your father worked on the Willard farm?
No, he was up on the farm in the Undermountain Road.
Oh, well, he never lived there then, on the Undermountain Road?
Yes, he lived on the farm. Yes. He was born on the farm.
He was born on the farm. That's when I remember when I first met him. I was sure he lived on that farm. And what was his father's name? In other words, your grandfather?
E. Barton. Edward E. Barton.
Edward E. Barton. And was he the first Barton to live on that farm?
No, his father, Pliny. Pliny Barton.
Pliny Barton was E. Barton's
father.
Father. Now, that would be your
born
great
1803
great. 1803.
1803.
That's what I thought. This went back a long, long time. Now, was he the first Barton? Or were there Bartons before?
There were more before that, but I don't go back any farther than that.
No, you don't know whether they were in town or whether or where they came from, really?
No. Great-great-great-grandfather was on the farm. But I don't know when.
Was this
before 1803.
This was before Pliny.
Right.
Before 1803.
Right.
So your family are one of the very earliest settlers in the whole town then, Dick?
One of the early
settlers. Where did they come from? Do you know? Did they come from England with the name Barton?
Yes. Came from England.
They came from England.
Yeah.
So he came from England in the 1700s, your forebear.
Right.
You're the gentleman before Pliny. As a matter of fact, two generations before Pliny.
Right.
You don't know what year they actually landed in Connecticut or the United
no,
States.
No, they go back to the Mayflower, actually.
They actually go back to the Mayflower. You're
yes.
telling me that a Barton came over on the Mayflower?
Mayflower.
Well, you're the first individual I have ever spoken with who told me right out and out that they came over on the Mayflower.
That's true.
And I have to respect you and your family an awful lot more now than I did before, and I had great respect for you. I remember your father very, very well. And I also remember your grandfather. Do you happen to remember, your father died in what year?
Died in 1952.
52. And do you happen to remember when his father died?
No, I don't know when he did.
Are your parents and your grandfather and your great grandfather, are they all buried in the Salisbury Cemetery?
Yes, they are.
The big cemetery.
Right.
Yes. That's very, very interesting. Do you, what did your father, I know that your grandfather was a farmer, essentially.
Right.
And I suppose your great grandfather and as far back as you can go, were they farmers?
They were farmers.
They were all farmers. And that was the original farm that they lived on.
Right.
And that goes back to, as far as you know, to the late 1700s or early?
First built.
Or early built?
When it was first built. That's when.
That's right. And it'd be the early 1800s probably when that house was built.
Be before that.
Because
my grandfather was born in 1803 then.
Yeah. So. That'd be, that house would be built in the 1700s. That would place it as one of the oldest houses in town then. Is any original part of the house still standing?
No.
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 That was torn down and rebuilt, I suppose. Did it ever burn by fire, do you know?
No.
They tore it down and rebuilt. Now, as I recall, when I was a youngster, out behind the house was a barn, a fairly substantial barn. And the earliest recollection I have was that your father and I believe it was your grandfather used to make cider.
Do you recall
that in your early days?
Oh, yes.
Or they made cider for years and years and years. And people came from miles around to get cider from your father and your grandfather.
And when he moved off the farm, he took the cider mill with him down on Route 41, the house on Route 41.
Oh, really? And did he continue to make cider
and
there?
I made cider when I was a kid. I can remember when I was a kid.
Did you really? Yes, yes.
Grinding up the apples,
yes,
picking.
Yes. Now, Dick, you have a brother whom I remember as Buzz. What was his right name?
It was George Edward Barton.
George Edward Barton, known as Buzz. Buzz is, last I knew, was in the Washington area.
He's in Springfield, Virginia.
Springfield, Virginia. Did he work in Washington?
Yes, he worked in
For the post office or the government?
The government.
For the government. And he's still living there?
Living in Springfield.
In Springfield, Virginia, which isn't too far out of Washington.
Right on the outskirts.
Right on the outskirts, yes.
15-minute drive.
And you have, do you have more than one sister?
I have two sisters.
You have just two sisters. Avis, everyone knows Avis. What was your other sister's
Mary.
Name? Was Mary.
Mary.
I do remember Mary. Very slim, slight girl, as Avis was too, of course, when she was young. Avis is presently living in Salisbury. And Mary is living where?
In Lakeville.
In Lakeville, is she?
In Boston.
Oh, she is married to
Reed Manning.
To Reed Manning. Now it all comes clear. So your whole family then is in Salisbury, except for Buzz.
Except
Buzz. Does Buzz ever get up to visit you?
Occasionally? Rarely.
You more often get out to visit him, I guess. When was the last time he was here in Salisbury?
He was up at the ski jumps probably 10 years ago.
Oh, 10 years ago? Yes, yes. Now, Buzz was the youngest of the family, or was married.
Mary was the youngest.
Mary was the youngest. And are you the eldest?
No. Avis.
Avis is
the oldest. Then Buzz. Then me.
Oh,
and Mary.
You're the third.
Third.
Well, that pretty well takes care of your family and your history, which is the history of your family is certainly a very interesting one. And I'm sure as in the town records, there's a great many references to the Barton name, or Barton family.
Yes, there should
be. There certainly must be. Now maybe we can get to something about Richard Lewis Barton, better known as Dick. I remember you as a kid. I think you went to the regional high school, did you not?
Yes.
You graduated from regional high school. After graduating from high school, did you immediately go into the Army, or did you go to any other school after that?
Day after graduation, I entered the Army.
You entered the Army?
Day after.
The Army, that was not the Marines.
Not the Army.
It was the regular Army. And what did you do in the Army?
I entered the Army, took my basic training in Alabama in June and July. August,
this was what year, Dick?
1946.
46 you entered the Army.
August of 1946, I sailed for Japan, and we stayed in Japan for 3 years, came back to the United States, stationed in Georgia for a year, went to Camp Drum, New York, been on several posts throughout the country, went to Germany. From there, I went to Germany.
About what year did you go to Germany?
1956, I went to Germany.
56.
1950, I went to Korea.
Korea was the biggest experience of your Army career, was it not?
No, one of them.
One of them. One of them. Well, we'll get to those later. You went to Korea in 1950, and I suppose you saw all kinds of action in Korea.
So, action, yes.
What division or regiment were you with in Korea?
Which was the 7th Division.
7th
Infantry Division. And the first time I came back to the United States in 51, I was stationed at Fort Devens, and then I went back to Korea for the second time in 52.
Now you saw action in Korea, I guess.
Yes.
Plenty of action. What was the first action you were in? What year was it?
1950. September 50.
In 50, you went to Korea for the first time. You had been to Japan previously. You went to Korea in 1950. Do you recall where you landed and what the circumstances were when you landed? Did you go immediately into action? Could you describe what?
That's when the North Koreans were overrunning the South Koreans, and they nearly annihilated them. We landed at Incheon.
You landed at Incheon.
Incheon. And we immediately went into action.
Yes, yes. Could you describe, Dick, from your memory, your landing in Incheon? Did you land under fire, or had you created a perimeter by that time? Or did you actually land under fire in Incheon?
So we landed under fire.
You landed under fire. So you know what it was all about. So upon landing, you established a foothold, a perimeter, and fought your way out of Incheon northward.
North.
And your effort was to force the North Koreans back.
Back over the 30th.
And you were successful over a long period of time. The fighting, as we heard it here, was fierce. Could you describe the action, the fighting that took place? At what time of the year was this?
It was the fall and winter of the first year.
The winter was bitter, was it not?
Very bitter, we were ill-equipped at first.
Ill-equipped. You were not properly clothed.
We brought what clothes we had, summer clothes, fatigues, and they anticipated the very short end of the war.
I see. That was mistaken.
But so eventually we got our winter equipment.
Yes, after you had been there for some time. There was a lot of misery of frostbite, freezing, frozen feet and hands.
A lot of it.
As I recall. Yeah. Another area of tremendous action, as I recall, was the Chosin Dam area.
Chosin River.
The Chosin River. Did you fight in that action?
No, we didn't get up there that far.
You didn't get up that far.
Marines were on one side and I think the 2nd Division was up there.
Yes, that was proven. At the time you went into Incheon, which I I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, was on the eastern coast of Korea.
Okay.
Perhaps the southeastern or the eastern?
Southeastern.
Southeastern. At the time you went into Incheon, was there any activity or effort being made on the opposite shore of Korea to land and join forces with you, or was the primary action, most of the action was in the Incheon area?
Most of the action was in the Incheon area.
So you had to land there and establish a foothold and gradually expand it, right?
Right.
Now, your weapons, your own personal weapons, were the rifle?
At that time we had carbines.
Carbines.
30 caliber carbine.
30 caliber. How many shots did these fire?
15 round clips.
15 round clips.
We taped them together and made 30 rounds out of them. Just turn them around.
Turn around.
Yeah.
And one. Did they automatically feed the whole 30 rounds? Or
right.
30 rounds?
No, the 15.
The 15,
then you had to.
Then you had to.
Twist it around.
You twist it around.
Put the bottom.
Yeah. Now, you were supported by machine gun fire.
Naval
bombardment.
Naval
bombardment first.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
To soften
them up. And then you went in. And this was not a pretty sight.
No, it was. They were pretty well dug in.
They were dug in. They were loosened up by naval fire. Any support from the air?
Air strikes.
And naval fire. So that did loosen them up to the point where you were able to inch forward. They were very determined fighters, were they not?
They were fanatical.
Yes. They'd rather die than retreat, I guess, in a way. What number of men actually landed in the Incheon affair, would you guess?
Well, all in all, I would say approximately 8,000.
About 8,000 troops in that initial landing. Now, you were reinforced gradually or sufficiently, would you say? Did the reinforcements come in?
Immediately.
Immediately.
As
soon as you were created, more came in.
Artillery, tanks.
Artillery and tanks. Were tanks effective in Korea?
Yes, they were.
They were effective. And your artillery was effective also, from what we've been given at least.
Yeah.
This Incheon invasion was masterminded by General Douglas MacArthur, and that proved.
That's true.
What type of feeling did your troops have for General MacArthur, Dick?
At the time, the feeling was we were all for him. Right?
You're all
100% with it.
Yes. You looked up to him as a strong and capable leader.
We did.
And you were ready to follow him, follow his orders. Was this a general feeling throughout the troops, from your observation?
It was, yes.
It was.
Most of the troops.
Good support. How long not the Incheon affair, but the actual fighting from the time you landed in Incheon, how long was it before you had pushed the North Koreans back to the DMZ that they now occupy?
A good 6-7 months.
6 to 7 months, during which the fighting was fierce. And many, many Americans died in that.
Many of them.
Many, many. I think they...
A big grave right there in Incheon.
I think...
Resembles Arlington.
The figure sticks in my mind. 50,000 troops fell.
50-some thousand
fell in Korea, Dick. You must have tremendous respect for those men who fought and died in Korea.
Yeah, I sure do. I knew a lot of them.
You knew a lot of them.
Didn't know them for long, but
No.
You keep meeting them.
And there we are today, still anchored south of that DMZ.
DMZ, yeah.
And what is your feeling for the whole Korean affair, Dick, now long, long after it's over? Was it worthwhile? Did we do the right thing?
I think that General MacArthur shouldn't have been stopped. We should have went right, took care of the whole thing when we were went over the river. But politics got involved and everything else. We had to stop short of the river.
Yeah. So you had to stop short of a complete victory. You were denied a complete victory.
True.
If you had been allowed to go on as General MacArthur wanted to do, would North Korea have been completely vanquished?
We would have, yes.
They would have been put out of the picture. And the and it would have been one Korea today, in your opinion?
There would have been
no communist control of North Korea?
None whatsoever.
No. So you feel, honestly, as a soldier and a patriot, that a mistake was made, that General MacArthur should have been permitted to go on over the Yalu River, bomb and with aerial support across the Yalu River, and to make it possible for the troops to proceed on north up through North Korea. You think
it would? I do, and everyone that I was associated with did also at the time.
Yes, and you think it was feasible. It probably would have cost more lives, no doubt. But you think it was feasible to do that at that time?
Yes. Everybody, we had the equipment, we were prepared. We could have done it very easily.
You were ready. In another 2 or 3 months, do you feel?
I think we could have. I think it would have taken a little longer.
Another 6 months,
perhaps. We would have got up to it.
Yes. What a shame. That was while you boys were fighting there, and when General MacArthur was replaced, the feeling ran very, very high in this country too, mostly I would say for General MacArthur. But President Truman at that time decided that he was insubordinate. He was not willing to obey his orders, so he replaced him. Is that essentially that's true. When General MacArthur was recalled, do you recall who replaced him? Was it General Ridgway, or do you recall who replaced
him? I don't recall who.
It might have been General Ridgway.
It could have been General Ridgway. I don't know for sure.
But at any rate, you came to a situation where the American troops and the South Korean troops arrived at a line called the DMZ, and a ceasefire was called at that time.
Right.
Then a great deal of talk went on as to what to do, and it was decided to stay there, to proceed no further, and establish this DMZ, above which would be North Korea, and below which would be the Republic of South Korea. What is, I don't know if you ever got to know any of the Korean people at all, but what is your assessment, your feeling about the South Koreans?
At the time, the South Korean people were down and out, and they were ordinary people. I mean, they didn't want to fight anymore than the next guy. They were farmers.
They were farmers.
I mean,
what they wanted was peace.
Most of their land was devastated. We brought all this big tanks and all this machinery and artillery in, and it ruined all their farmland. It's just about, well, we didn't ruin the North Koreans. They burned every village on their way back up. They just cleaned the area right out.
So many, those poor South Korean people died and suffered and starved and were displaced from their homes. It must have been a sorry sight. Well, so much for Korea, Dick. I think you've painted a pretty good picture of it. After Korea, what happened to you in your military career?
Well, after Korea, I came back to the United States, and I stayed home about a year, and then I was reassigned over to Germany. Went to Germany in 1954 through 56, 2 years in Germany. I was reassigned back to Waterbury, where I was on recruiting duty. I stayed on recruiting duty for 2 years. And then I was assigned to Ethiopia. I went over to Ethiopia, stayed there for a year, came back to the United States, and then went to Vietnam.
Just Ethiopia, just for a moment. What was the situation in Ethiopia at that time? Were the Italians going into Ethiopia at that time?
No, the Italians were all out of Ethiopia.
They were all
out. Haile Selassie was the supreme leader.
He was the ruler at that time. So when you left Ethiopia, it was still under Haile Selassie.
It was still under Haile Selassie's rule.
What happened to Ethiopia later was a pretty cruel thing, was it not?
It was.
Okay, now we have gotten you out of Ethiopia, and you went to Vietnam. In what year did you go to Vietnam?
I went to Vietnam in 1962, when the buildup was just starting there. And I was signed over to Cam Ranh Bay. It was a peninsula in the central coast on the Red Sea, right on the Red Sea. And we established a supply base for all the troops in Vietnam. There was an open port. Supplies came in through Cam Ranh Bay. They built an airstrip there, 2 mile long airstrip, and threw supplies in. I stayed there a year, and then I came back to the United States. Stationed down at Fort Lee, Virginia. And I stayed there 6 months. I put in to go back to Vietnam. I didn't like stateside duty at the time. Went back to Vietnam, assigned to the 4th Infantry Division, Pleiku, in Con Tum. And I made it there just in time for the Battle of Dak Tho with the 4th Division. I lost quite a few members. The 101st Airborne lost almost all their troops on that one operation up in the Central Highlands. I put in my year there and decided it was time to hang up my boots. I retired in first of July 1968.
Of 1968. But, Dick, this is a big question. I'd like your assessment of the whole Vietnam picture. And after you have assessed that, I'm going to ask you one question. What do you think of the whole Vietnam circumstance?
I really don't think that we should have started in there.
We shouldn't have been there in the first place.
That's my feelings about that one.
Yes.
I guess you grow older, you have different feelings about
yes.
career.
Yes.
Definitely
yes.
patriotic. And
yes, yes. It's an entirely different situation than Korea. So you have this strong,
all the way.
You have the strong feeling we never belonged in Vietnam at all.
If we were there, we would have, should have changed. We should have had the control over it. We didn't need that control over everything we've done over there. We had all the troops and all the equipment that they still gave the orders. I couldn't see that.
Now my question is this. Having gotten ourselves into Vietnam,
there were Vietnamese people,
you
peasants
think
by
we
day,
position
by night,
that?
They were Viet Cong.
Win that campaign.
Same
you know, we could have won had we
had
and you didn't know who was
you, you didn't know
ever.
Who you were fighting. It's, no, hard. No, it's hard to fight a war.
Do you think there was a time when we could have won
the Vietnam? Well, we could have. It's hard to tell who's who.
Yes.
We would have had to annihilate the whole race.
Yes.
Actually, to find out to take it.
I have
it's
been told,
warfare,
I have read, that had we bombed the northern area up around the reservoir, the lake area,
Haiphong.
And northern Haiphong, had we gone in there and bombed that, I mean a real, real intensive bombing, that the whole northern part of North Vietnam, Vietnam, would have been helpless. That there would have been flooding, uncontrollable flooding, and probably that would have knocked them out of the war. Do you think
that would have?
It probably would have
killed
them.
A lot of innocent children,
yes,
and
yes,
women,
yes,
and old people.
So somewhere along the line, that decision was made not to do that.
Right.
So, in effect, we were in another war that we were not allowed to win. Is this true in your opinion?
That's true.
Yes, that's a sorry thing. And when it was a very unpopular war in this country, I guess it was even unpopular with the men who were over there fighting it. And when the men came back from Vietnam, they got very, very little glory for what they did. Very, very small thanks. And very little glory. They were very unfairly treated. Do you feel this is true?
I myself don't. There's many do.
Yes. Yes.
I didn't do any army to be praised and everything. I patriotic, do my duty. That was it. I had no bitter feelings. Quite a few other people that I've talked to had no bitter feelings. I think they brought it on themselves. Before Korean veterans, you see them in parades at home and everything else. They're well dressed and neat, but these Vietnam veterans, they still want to stick to their beards and their jungle fatigues. And they just can't let go of those things. I don't know why, but they just seem. I think they're a special breed. I don't believe it.
That's a very interesting observation, Dick. It's true that they became a bearded, long-haired group. Maybe they were treated maybe they got the type of treatment that they earned. I don't know. That's not for me to say, but I think you have the same feeling, perhaps. Okay, now, Dick, we've gotten you through two wars. We've gotten you through Germany and Ethiopia. And now in 1968. No, what year did we get you back here?
68. July of 1968.
We got you back. And, the country in 1968. Now, you were still in the army.
I retired 1st of July, 1968.
You retired from the army. Okay, so I think you came back to Salisbury that time.
Right, I came
back. You did.
To Lakeville. To Lakeville. Right here.
To Lakeville. This house. To this house. Incidentally, the house that we're speaking of is on Montgomery Street, just below the Masonic Temple. The earliest remembrance I have of this place, it was the people who lived here were named Green. I think Mr. Green worked in the knife shop, I'm not sure. I believe he did. So this house is quite an old house.
Yeah, the farthest I can date back is 1848.
1848.
It's built.
So it's approaching 150 years of age now. And you've made it very cozy and very, very solid here, Dick.
A lot I think of work.
You must be very happy here. Okay, now we've gotten you back back to this country, and we've gotten you retired from the Army. Now what took place in your life?
I came back and I started looking for a job. I got a job doing carpentry work with Nils Herring, local contractor here. And I stayed there for a while, and I found out that Skeet Morey was going to retire from the post office as custodian. So I approached the postmaster and asked him if I could put in for the job. So he gave me the paperwork and I filled it out. I put in for the job in September 6th of 1968. I started working in the post office.
So you've been with the post office for 20 years now?
20 years. It'll be 20 years in September.
20 years. So it's been a good second career for you, really.
It has. It's right near home.
Would you think, as you look back on your life, that your major career was your Army service?
I would, yes.
This is the big point in your whole life was your Army service.
Best years of my life, 17 years old to 40.
Yes. I have the feeling you're very, very proud of your service in the Armed Forces.
I am.
And well, you should be. And well, we should all be proud of you. Now, you came back and you retired in 1968. When did you meet your wife, Mary?
I met my wife when I was on recruiting duty in Waterbury, 1961. And we were married in 1962, January 62, just before I went to Vietnam.
What was her feeling about you going back to
Vietnam?
She
wasn't happy at all.
Not at all.
She knew that I spent all the time.
What did you tell her at that time?
I told her.
You got to go?
I thought that if my duty to go, starting to build up over there, and I had some experience, so I figured somebody over there to take these young troops in the hand. And more of them wouldn't have been killed, by me.
Now, you went back to Vietnam as a staff sergeant or a sergeant?
A sergeant.
You went back as a sergeant?
Tech sergeant.
Tech. Did you come out as a sergeant?
I came out as first sergeant.
First sergeant.
Took over first sergeant.
Yes. So you retired as a first sergeant.
As a first sergeant.
Yes. So, when did you buy this house?
Bought this house in 1962.
62.
Reverend Stone.
Reverend Stone.
Oh. The time.
I didn't realize that Reverend Stone.
He owned it.
Yes.
At the time.
So now your family, Mary, your children. You have children.
I have children.
You have children. Tell us about your children.
I have two sons. One was born in 1963, that's Richard J. Barton, the oldest son. He went to local schools, and then he went to Oliver Wolcott Technical School in Torrington for high school years. Graduated from there. He's an auto mechanic now. He's interested in racing cars. He worked for Alpha Racing last year as a chief mechanic. This year he's working at the auto shop.
In Salisbury?
In Salisbury.
Okay.
My younger son, George, born in 1969, April of 69. He attended local schools. And he went to Salisbury School for his high school years. And he's now a freshman in University of Connecticut. That's my children.
Two boys. And they're both doing well. And then the names again were
Richard J. Barton.
Richard J.
And George Edward Barton.
George Edward. George Edward is named for your father.
My father.
Well, Dick, I want to thank you very much for this interview. It's been, I think you dug down pretty deep in your soul some of the things you've told us today. And I want to say personally that I have a tremendous amount of respect for you, things that you've done for your country. Mm-hmm. I'd like to end it on that note. Unless there's something you would like to say to future citizens of the town of Salisbury, would you like to make a statement to end this interview?
No, I have nothing else to say.
You have nothing else to say. Well, then I will simply say thank you very, very much, Dick. I've enjoyed it. And I'm sure that this tape, someday, people will listen to it with a great amount of pride.
I hope so. I think it's a great project here we've got going here. I hope that people will follow suit.
Thank you very much, Dick. Appreciate it.